The True False podcast is made possible with the support of the University of Missouri and the Donald W. Reynolds Journalism Institute.
Welcome to the True False Film Festival.
It is a surprise, I think, for people to see themselves recreated in cinematic language. And to see their stories told back to them in cinematic grammar.
Welcome to the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeld. In this episode, we're bringing you a conversation between Kim Hopkins, director of Voices of the Sea, and the directors of America, Eric Stoll and Chase Whiteside. Both Voices of the Sea and America are not the documentaries their respective filmmakers set out to make. Kim made Voices of the Sea after a previous documentary broke down. She had just enough money to buy a plane ticket to Cuba and follow a Cuban fisherman named Pita and his wife, Mariela. Eric and Chase stumbled across their main character, Diego, who, with his brothers, moves home to take care of his aging grandmother. The three directors spoke at a 2018 True False field session called Reflect. Here's Chase.
Something I think that we can, look at about both of our films is that neither of us are native Spanish speakers, mm-hmm. none of us, and we made films that are predominantly in Spanish. Mm-hmm. In our case, we had a kind of curve where we, at the beginning, we basically didn't speak much Spanish. Mm-hmm. But by the end of the process, which was many years, we did. But that wasn't always true. And so in some of the early footage, we would go and think of it as being maybe even very compelling in something, and mm-hmm. we would discover it was less compelling than we thought when we really got the full translation. It mm-hmm. went the other way as well, mm-hmm. where there was great meaning in some of the nuance of the way certain things were said, but we didn't really find out until we were getting, mm-hmm. we had a few things, the simpler stuff we didn't end up needing to get transcribed, but there were a few, especially in our film, dense arguments mm-hmm. where people are kind of rapidly, you know, mm-hmm. saying things to one another where it wasn't, for me, until the transcription came back that I really was like, you know, this or that, that's what they're saying. Did you find it to be a challenge to take the footage you have and turn it into a film without
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
How did you do it?
I mean, Dominic learned his Spanish in Spain.
That's Kim.
Dominic, who was our interpreter.
So I don't speak
Spanish.
Oh, okay.
And so when we went into Cajo village, he just looked at me. He said, I don't understand a word.
It's very challenging. He's Spanish.
Yeah. I consider myself.
And he said, this is like Glaswegian, it's like the Scots, and it took him ages to get his ear.
Yeah.
In and that coupled with him not having any film experience meant pretty much I was winging it so much. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would get rid of him quite often, and just keep saying to myself, "This is a visual language. This is a visual language.
Right.
I don't need, you know, just trying to." After a while, you kind of get into a kind of rhythm. You kind of just start picking stuff up.
Yeah.
Even though it would take me, I don't think I would ever learn. I'm just terrible with languages.
Sure.
It was amazing that you actually learned a language as you were filming. I didn't. I still can only ask for a beer.
That's one of the more important things to know in another language.
Exactly, prioritize. And in fact, not knowing the language kind of is beneficial sometimes, because when we got the material back, there was a scene where he had a radio mic on, and once got it translated, he was talking to his doctor, and he's going, "That film crew's still here after 10 weeks. He said, "They're everywhere in my house." And as being a Brit, and I would have been mortified if I'd known that was happening. But, you know, I was kind of just, know, because I didn't know the language, I would, you know, I would kind of impose myself on in the middle of conversations and things. So I think that kind of ignorance sometimes is good.
Well, how did you explain the project to him?
That's Eric.
And how did that change, and how do you think he and any of your subjects understand the project? It's something I think a lot about, because you can do your very best to explain to someone, like, it's a documentary, it's like a movie, but it'll take years to make.
Don't look at the camera, but nobody really knows what they're, what they're getting themselves into.
No, I don't think I've ever managed to explain properly what it is we're doing. Mm-hmm. I think it always remains a mystery until they see it, and then all of a sudden it's, whoa,
right?
I'm in a movie.
And it looks
how
like
did
a movie.
That happen?
Yeah.
They thought we were making a film about a fisherman and his family, and I was making a film about a fisherman and his family. The other stuff that came along, the kind of Exodus, the rafters and things like that, that was an organic thing that happened. And in fact, that was introduced to me by Peter. We knew it was happening, but we didn't realize it was so endemic. Right. So that kind of, that part of the narrative was given.
Last spring, or some springs ago, I was in Cuba for a few weeks on a shoot, and about sort of what their preparations were for climate change and how climate change was affecting the island and so forth. And, you know, we were going around and I was really kind of impressed with what we were seeing and the people we were talking to. And then I like happened to hop on like the New York Times or something like one morning, and there was this big front page article about Cuban migration. And I forget the statistic, but it was like, you know, it was this 5 to 10,000 a month at this one point in the month, and it blew my mind just from the few weeks I'd spend there that on the fringes there were just a massive exodus.
And of course, it's not very well documented,
right?
So nobody really knows.
There's something you said about it's a movie that when they see it, they find they're like, oh wow, it's a movie. I really think this is a big thing with making a film, especially for us when we never really made a feature film before, that. It almost works to your advantage that the people you're filming think maybe you're totally more amateur than you are. and it's a testament to both of you who are, Eric shot our film and is a wonderful cinematographer.
Thank you.
So are you. That both of you bring a lot of cinema to, it doesn't feel like kind of, I think sometimes we think of verite as stuff that's looking a little, I think reality TV and maybe 90s DV cams left us all imprinted with this impression of what it means to be verite shooting. But both Voices of the Sea and the footage Eric shot for America is broadly cinematic.
Yes, it is.
And it is a surprise, I think, for people to see themselves recreated in cinematic language and to see their stories told back to them in cinematic grammar. And
And there's just you two. There's nobody else on the crew. Just you two.
Yeah. Just us. Yeah.
And I think that also that comes as a surprise to them, because I think people expect.
Yeah, they think
cinema comes from crews of people and cameramen with lights.
That's
and
right.
Bigger cameras than we're carrying around. And
yeah, it makes me wonder if it's an advantage or disadvantage that this kind of like independent, creative documentary is still. Not very widely seen, that people don't really have, many people don't really have an imagination of what this kind of work looks like, of what its purpose is. Mm-hmm. Their references are frequently either like reality TV show or news.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I'm always wondering if it's an advantage or disadvantage that, I mean, broadly, I wish this kind of work was seen much more widely and everyone was familiar with it and loved it and went to doc festivals. But in terms of, explaining what you're doing to people and trying to give them a sense of what they're a part of, I go back and forth on whether I think it's to our advantage or disadvantage that it's sort of a kind of obscure.
I guess we don't really know ourselves either, do we?
What we're doing.
Yeah.
But at least like what kind of media product, what market look like.
Yeah, the whole thing. I'm convinced that we just, the best stuff comes from not really knowing what you're doing. Yeah.
Coming up after the break, Chase, Eric, and Kim talk about gender on screen in their documentaries.
Gendered relationships and power dynamics in reality are reproduced through documentary.
First, a word from our sponsors.
Hey
Hey, listeners, it's Allison, letting you know that this episode of the True False Podcast is brought to you by the University of Missouri. That's also where we produce this show, here at the KBIA studios at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, which is famous for the Missouri Method. So we've got Catherine Wheeler here in the studio. Catherine's a graduate student at the University of Missouri School of Journalism, and she is a producer on our podcast for True False. Hey, Catherine.
Hi.
I was hoping you could tell us what you mean when we say Missouri Method.
Well, with the J School, we're kind of getting thrown into the deep end right away. I don't know any other place where on my first day of class, I was writing feature stories for the local newspaper, and I'm working at the local NPR affiliate doing stories. There are just so many options to really get professional experience even before we go out into our professional careers.
Yeah, the experience stuff is really what stands out, I think.
Yeah.
The True False Podcast is made possible by the University of Missouri. This episode of the True False Podcast is brought to you by the Donald W. Reynolds Journalism Institute. Here to tell us more is current RJI fellow Chris Gass. Hey, Chris.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So what's your elevator pitch for your project?
Sure. If you're a small and medium-sized news organization, if you're a local paper, a radio station, getting on board with modern mobile news app systems is expensive and probably not really an option for you. So this is something that lets you basically take a pre-made system, modify it to your needs. In a couple days, you can have a completely native iOS and Android apps for all your readers.
Oh, yeah. That sounds amazing.
Yeah, it's a lot cheaper than the $50K that it usually costs. So.
Yeah, and this would be free, open source.
Completely free. Anybody can take it. Anybody can download it. You change a couple config files. You might have to hire a developer for like 2 or 3 days. That's what RJ is letting me work on.
Chris, again, he is a current Reynolds Journalism Institute fellow. We're really excited that you are sponsoring our podcast, taking a long look at the work of filmmakers, not unlike journalists who get to settle in with their work here at the RJI Fellowships. And the True False Podcast is, of course, as I just said, sponsored by the Reynolds Journalism Institute. You can find out more at rjionline.org. That's rjionline.org. Welcome back to the True False Podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kotvalt. Let's get back to the conversation between Eric Stoll, Chase Whiteside, and Kim Hopkins.
I really admire people who will approach someone who does not want to be a part of a film, who does not want to be filmed, who does not like being filmed, who is shy, who is awkward, who is anything, and will slowly develop a relationship or convince them that for some reason they should do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's hard. I can't imagine doing that.
I don't think it's a skill
set
we have.
Yeah. Like, if you
just
want to be filmed,
if
you're enthusiastic from the beginning, if you're confident, with your body and your words and your gestures, then let's do it. I want to be there. But it's hard to imagine me ever trying to like coerce or convince anyone like who wasn't kind of naturally comfortable.
Yeah.
To do it.
I'm interested in Mariella as a character in that regard. She seems, between her and Pita, to be a little more reserved. Pita's obviously larger than life as a character.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of scenes where you even see that dynamic at play where he's like, even when he's trying to get her, he's trying to sleep with her. And she's all like, not, he's like, literally not right now. And that interplay is lovely in the film. And then there's this scene where she's alone at the house she aspires to finish. And I feel like she opens up in a way that she doesn't when Pete is around. And we see later that scene where she kind of opens up the interview, but she didn't really open up. She just gets up and leaves. But in the house, when she opens up like that, I wonder, was it different when she was alone?
We actually took her away from Peter because of that.
You can feel it.
We could feel it. And yes, Mariella was slightly more reserved, slightly more. But Mariella had a little bit of English. Mariella's story was the most difficult part of the film to tell. And I think it was Leah, the editor, that really pulled that Mariella. I was kind of battling with this part of the story because I was wanting to know whether Mariella was going to leave or not leave. That was what I was wrestling with all the time. And Leah just kind of... basically said, I think it's about somebody just trapped, that she's not going to leave, but she feels trapped. And it's a very small difference, but vital to informing how we cut the film.
Well, it makes me think about something I think a lot about, which is how sort of like gendered relationships and power dynamics in reality are reproduced through documentary. So, for example, like within the relationship, I mean, he's obviously sort of dominant. He says to her, you know, you should adapt to me. I'm not, can't adapt to you, which is partially an age thing, but like,
right.
But not only, right? And so I feel like it's a thing I see in films in which female characters, women characters, who within, say, their sort of hetero relationship might be shyer or just sort of less empowered to speak, end up being smaller characters in the film for the same result, that the film is attracted towards movement, towards dynamism.
People are going to aggressively put themselves...
Force of character in these things. Mm-hmm. And so that's something really impressive, is that Marielle is able to emerge as
a full character,
despite the weight of PETA's charisma and sort of patriarchal, you know, authority within
his family. I mean, PETA's a man of the earth, you know, or a man of the sea. I mean, Marielle's got more intellect. And PETA knows that.
Yeah.
He knows that. And so that kind of that Marielle was able to give us that dimension, I think, in the film. PETA's, which is very basic and very, very fisherman-like. Anyway, that's enough about my film for now.
Hopefully
we'll... I knew that we were going to be doing this, and so I was thinking about this kind of similarities and I was thinking, you know, I'm kind of more or less the same age as PETA, and I kind of had that, I could feel that. And then I kind of realized that with your, which I can't remember the name of your character, but you're kind of more or less, again, the same age as some of your central characters. Do you think we just naturally gravitate towards?
Well, speaking for me, I mean, when we met Diego, we were working in Puerto Vallarta, kind of trying to make a bigger tourist film. And it was going slowly. It was very difficult. Our Spanish was pretty poor. I am actually pretty shy, like out in the field. I'm not just going to like, even in English, just going to walk up to anyone and be like, so what do you do? What do you think about this? What do you think about that? We're making a movie. Can we film you tomorrow? Mm-hmm. And so I think that, and so Diego started as a friend before a subject. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that sort of sense of peerness, of closeness as friends, which doesn't have to be because we're age peers, but certainly it facilitates it. Yeah. I think like so that we were peers and friends before making a film, I think was key to the whole everything. Yeah.
But along those lines, it initially happened because when we met Diego, like 2 days after we arrived in Puerto Vallarta, where we originally had set out to make this film, we met Diego at a party. And the reason we really met Diego at a party and not some of the other people at the party is because Diego spoke really good English and our Spanish was still bad, and Diego was like kind of excited to use his English to talk to us. Mm-hmm. And he was fascinating and he was cool. And at the end of the night he said, you know, would it be okay if I stayed with you guys tonight? Because he didn't have a place to stay. And I think I said no or something like that. And Eric said, come on, it's fine, which I'm grateful for. And that's when we first just befriended Diego. He didn't become the subject in our film right away. It wasn't a PETA kind of moment. He was always good on camera and ignoring the camera, but it wasn't this obvious, like, oh, he's perfect. It was actually when he returned home to Colima and we saw America on camera for the first time that we thought, oh, okay, this is worth radically abandoning what we were working on to pursue.
Did you recognize that straight away with America? Because, I mean, she does come through.
I mean, honestly, the very first scenes with America in the film... was the very first footage I saw, because Eric had gone to visit Diego when Diego went home, as if not necessarily to follow a film, but just to check in on a friend and go see and maybe film, but it wasn't that we had no idea. And the day after you'd gotten down there and shot, uploaded and sent me footage, a bunch of footage, like some of it, scenes. And so the first time you see America in the film is the first time I saw America. So I saw her first on screen. And it was obvious how mesmerizing and compelling she was in that first moment when she says, you know, I'm sorry, I'm just waking up now. It's like, she's sorry she's just now appearing in the film. She's sorry she's just now appearing in our project and production. I mean, it seems to stand in for so much for us.
But yeah, it started from a point of being interested in, you know, in the U.S. border and in, you know, these countries, I mean, with tightly shared histories and populations and cultures and economies and everything, right? And so, so it started from a place of that.
Yeah, the reason why we made the film, I'd love to say it was some kind of deep, kind of philosophical need that I had to go and make a film in Cuba, but really it was a film that I was working on in the UK, collapsed after 6 months, and it was just blind panic. It was. I've had a kind of seed, rough idea in my head about a film about Cuba. We're really, really running out of money. We can afford to buy a van, so we can do some deliveries, or we can just say, "Shall we buy some tickets to Cuba?" And I'll try and make this film in Cuba that has been mulling around in my head, and that was the reason.
How do you tell a complicated story about Cuba, about Cubans, in a sort of discursal, binary discursal context of like your pro-Castro regime, you know, the United States is the imperial bully for which all problems are to be blamed, versus, you know, the Cuba is a closed totalitarian society and the Castro regime is this rotting dictatorship, whatever. How do you think about how your film could be used or could be perceived within this really sort of simplistic?
That's a tough question, and I don't know how it's going to be perceived. I don't know whether I'm ever going to get back into Cuba again. I have no idea. I don't know how the Cuban authorities will respond to it. I don't think anybody really knows this stuff because there was a film made, I think, in the late 90s, called Balsteros, Rafters, and it dealt with some very tricky issues with a revolution, and Balsteros went on to win the Oscar that year, the documentary Oscar, I think it won. It was certainly nominated, and then it went into the Havana Film Festival, and it won a prize there, so you never know. They may embrace it in some way. It depends how they see it, because there is also some criticism of the US and the American dream. I hope it kind of balances that out. But the kind of short answer to it is how do you tell a story about this history is you can't really. You just have to use a kind of microcosm, which is what I tried to do.
I just want to say thank you for sharing your beautiful film with us.
And thank you for sharing your even more beautiful film.
Talking to us. Thank you. Yeah.
That's all for this episode of the True False podcast. You can find more of our conversations about nonfiction filmmaking at kbia.org, in iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a review. It'll help more people find the show. Thank you to Eric Stoll and Chase Whiteside, who, shout out to Wright State, came here as students. And thank you so much to Kim Hopkins for this conversation. This episode was produced by Aviva Okeson-Haberman and edited by Ryan Familiner and Bram Sablesmith. Our introduction was created by Tim Pilcher using sounds from the True False Film Fest. The song you heard was Marissa Anderson's Into the Light. Join us next time as we discuss a new aspect of the art and craft of nonfiction film. I'm Allison Koval. Thanks for listening.